To me, this what you're saying is that getting their trust and getting a connection with them out of the room is important first.
100%. It's never not that. Like, it's always being a good person first.
Welcome to the Cloud Machine Podcast, your all-access pass to the music industry. I'm your host, Matt Landry, and every week we immerse you in the music world, uncovering industry insights, offering expert guidance, and exploring the stories that influence the industry. The Cloud Machine Podcast is brought to you by Aites, the innovative creative agency behind some of your favorite live concerts and tours. Want to take your music to the next level? Join our vibrant community on the Aites Network Discord. And with that, let's get started with today's episode. Welcome back to the Cloud Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Landry, and today we have the immense pleasure of talking with Jarvis Jeb Barnes, a dynamic drummer, keyboard player, playback engineer, music director, YouTuber, if that's fair, and maybe even a motivational coach. Jarvis has been making waves in the music industry lately, particularly with his work as the drummer for Tate McRae, one of today's most recognizable and fastest rising stars. Fresh off the North American leg of her Think Later World Tour that just rocked Madison Square Garden, Jeb's journey is nothing short of inspiring. Today we explore how his diverse skill set from live drumming to playback, musical direction, and content creating has propelled him to some of the biggest stages in the world, and what it's like working with an artist like Tate, and more. So let's dive in. Hey Jarvis, how are you?
Great, man. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I want to start off the podcast by asking you about your favorite live show experience as a fan.
As a fan? Oh, wow. Oh, there's so many. I'll give two. Obviously, my first concert ever was seeing Janet Jackson.
Yes. Wow.
So I remember that as a kid, seeing that performance, like knowing exactly how it felt. I remember the smell. I remember who I was sitting next to. Like, I just remember every aspect of that show and thinking, this is great.
Yes.
I didn't have a lot of drummers they saw a show and they're like, this is what I want to do.
Right.
I think drums was kind of like innately in me. So I kind of knew that's what I was going to do. But that was definitely one. And then I would just say a blanket thing is like any concert that my friends are a part of, I think is always incredibly rewarding. Like, it's always amazing to do what we do, but when you can see your genuine friends, like your brothers and sisters doing like just amazing things, you're like, yes, guys, like so awesome to be a part. And it's small theater up to stadiums. Like, it doesn't matter. It's like, as long as you're out there giving it your all, I love seeing my friends doing amazing things. So yeah, that's, let's say Janet and then asterisks.
Yeah. I mean, there's something about like seeing the fringe and seeing like the village sort of do what they want and stuff like that, you know.
For
you, are there specific times that you saw, like, you know, you, like you're saying, your brother's sister, maybe somebody that you a coworker from the past, seeing them shine on stage that is remarkable?
Absolutely. One of my best friends, John Witt, co-MD with Drew on the Casey Musgraves gig. And yeah. I wasn't super hip to Casey. It's not music that always just comes across my desk to want to even learn or to consume.
Yes.
However, you know, it's like, all right, your best friend's playing a show. Like, I bought my ticket. I didn't even ask him for a comp. Like, I bought my ticket. Right. I'm there.
Right.
And then just going and seeing how amazing they were. Musically, obviously, all of those guys that are on that stage are
monsters.
Top. Yeah, like they just don't miss, you know.
Yeah.
On top of just witnessing like production, how she interacted with the fans, how she interacted with the band, how the band interacted with themselves, you know, the reception and feeling of the room, mm-hmm. seeing like the ups, like the whole thing top to bottom was just a very rewarding time to see your friend be a part of that and also know that he had a great responsibility of editing sonically how it translated over. As well as like bands and crew and usually don't always get recognition, but she had a whole credit reel of everyone's name. And I was like, wow, this is amazing that she has taken note to, I mean, everyone from K cameras operators got noticed. Like, it wasn't just the band or, you know, background. It was just everyone that was a part of making that come true was like in the credits. And I was like, wow, that's really cool moment. And to know that your friends, obviously a extension, but also one of your best friends, like has a key to my place. That's how close we are.
Yeah.
Is out here winning. You know, it's like, yes.
Yeah.
You know, so cool.
I want to circle back to something that you just mentioned, where it's like tour credits and stuff. And for me, it was a big eye opener when Beyonce shared hers last year for the Renaissance World Tour. Seeing like the 300 plus people on that tour credit list. There's something about that that's just so empowering to the people that you work with. And also like for industry people like ourselves to see who was on the tour, you know, and seeing them being reflected in her like assets, you know, and she like promoted it. For you, what does that mean? You know, you're talking about Mr. John Witt Jr. as well, getting that credit and shout out to that band too. Such a crazy band. I saw them in Barcelona a few years ago. One of my top three shows
ever.
For you, what does that mean to you when you do get the nod, even like the you know the typical like drum solos and like Jarvis on the drums, like those moments are very special and empowering to those people, without even talking about the tour list and the credits. What does that sort of mean to you when artists do that?
I think it means everything, you know, because you get this. I'm going to drift off for a second, but I promise I'll come back to how it is. But, you know, a lot of times you get this word thrown at you is like exposure, you know, and people will ask you to take gigs for exposure. And, you know, it's like it'll be a good thing for your career and it's good exposure. It's like, well, what does that actually mean? And is exposure actually going to pay your bills?
Yes.
Sometimes it can. But most of the time it doesn't, unless, you know, and realistically, like if your artist is directly going to call another artist, be like, you need to put my drummer on. Name a time that's ever happened. I'm sure that, like back in the days, I'm sure that did happen, but it's not something that will always happen. But in today's age, with all these clips going viral, if your artist says your name on the stage or there can be an extensive amount of footage of you being in the credits, like, people can actually see you in thousands and thousands of clips actually sitting on the stage. Like, that matters. And it comes across to other musical directors or playback engineers or lighting directors. Like, man, I heard that guy that was on Tate and I don't know the guy, but he sounded incredible. Oh, let's find out who he was. And they can quickly see like, oh yeah, I do like his feel. I don't like his image, or I do like his image. Like, they can quickly kind of dissect a lot of different things. But if your artist is saying that name, it's like, you would hope that they're not saying this because I need a body. You're hoping that they're saying it's like, oh, he is a somebody or she is a somebody to me on the stage. Like, it matters. Their gifts that are here matters to me. Yes. So I think that's what it means to me when an artist does that. And they may not even say it off the stage to you, but you can genuinely feel like, I don't know, for me, it's like when Tate, and she does talk to us off stage, but like when Tate says it on stage, like you can tell she genuinely wants the crowd to give it up for me. It's not just like it's a bit in the show. It feels like she actually wants this to be a moment, and she wants all thousands of her listeners in this room right now to keen in on what's going on over here. And it just means the world to me. So hopefully that answers the question enough there.
It's fantastic. It just talks to, you know, the importance of just like the village around a production as well, and just like how every role is really important, not necessarily only on stage, but all the people on stage as well. For you, I wanted to ask you about what makes a live experience memorable.
Oh, there's a lot of different things.
Yeah.
I would say your team is number one. If you got a good team, like your Dissension, like if you have a good crew that can get your stage up and down quickly and they're also not exhausted and all these things like that matters. And in your audio team, like for monitor, front of the house, playback engineers, your techs, like your RF people, it's like if they're solid and they're fun, that's fun, you know? And then if you have all these things and bits and pieces that put a show together, be a good type family, that's always rewarding.
Yeah.
And then I'll give it from the other side of it is like, as a player, obviously when you get those moments where you see fans that are singing the songs and they're dancing and they're really vibing with you, that's rewarding. Or when you work with artists like I played for Jordan Sparks and playing No Air in Battlefield, like, come on. You know, this is like billions and billions of streams that have been listened to and it's still on the radio. Like, you'll hear Chris Brown still in his set sings No Air.
Yeah.
You know, you just can't deviate from like that, those types of experiences when you have such iconic songs that you're playing mm-hmm. in front of, like, and that song thing was a stadium. The first thing I did, whatever, the stadium. The second thing was something different, but very, very cool.
I want to get into the quote segment of the podcast. You also mentioned, you know, going from MDs or artists checking you out because of your image, saying, oh, you know, I want to hire this person because of their image. This quote that we're doing this year is somewhat about that. It's about, you know, the entire package. It's a quote from 2004, so 20 years ago. It's a Joni Mitchell quote. She said, I heard someone from the music business saying that they are no longer looking for talent. They want people with a certain look and a willingness to cooperate. What are your first instincts when you hear this sentence?
I think it's a lot to unpack.
Yes.
I don't think it's a very short answer. I think there's definitely some truth and merit to what that statement is saying. Mm-hmm. You definitely have people that don't have talent that get on, or and from every facet, right? It's not just artist wise. It's up to, you know, camera operators. You know, some people are just like there. But I would argue also that talent and hard work are still winning. I don't think it's just the, oh, you have a cute look or a nice smile, let me throw you on the stage and I can make you a star. It's like people now are really yearning for authenticity.
Yeah.
And I think people are doing a really good job now that we've kind of been in this technology thing, weeding out the BS, if you will. And they can feel if a conversation is authentic. They can feel if a VIP is authentic. They can feel if when yes. you're delivering a lyric, if it's authentic. They can feel if you're, you know, I'll give a clear thing. It's like musicians always appreciate a moment. And I think fans do too, but they won't be able to appreciate what I'm saying until I say it. Is that if you have an artist that can place their microphone stand there, put the microphone there and just deliver a lyric without anything else going on, they always win the crowd over. I don't care what you say. Or like in Tate's show, she sits on the edge and it's just her, myself, and Zach is next to her.
Yeah.
And that's it. There's no other backing tracks. There's nothing else happening. It's just an authentic moment. There's not a bunch of lighting. There's no dancing. It's like people can connect to what's happening and they can feel if that's a moment of the authenticity.
Right.
So I think, yeah, image does matter. And sure, there's definitely people that are out there just trying to build a bear, essentially. But there's also a ton of really, really talented artists that are up and coming, doing really, really great things, who are actually good singers, that are actually good people, that are authentic. They truly do love their fans. Like there's both sides. So I guess that's my first response, is that it's a weighted question that does have some merit. But I don't want people to listen to that and get discouraged. Like, well, they're just going to pick this person anyway. I'm not going to try. No, that's not real. There's benefits of trying. There's benefits of trying to be authentic and move the way you're supposed to move and nourish your gifts from God. Like, don't get discouraged by hearing that. That's
Yeah. Now, a general question for you. Where do you think the industry is going?
I can only speak to live just because that's the main world that I work in. Yeah. I don't know anything else when it comes down to record ears or A&R. I don't know that world, so I can't speak to it. I think live is transitioning back to live instrumentation. There's always going to be an element of technology because you can't avoid it. So anybody who's on this can't use backing tracks, so they don't use like vocal processing. It's like, get over yourself. Like, we're moving things along. This is like the part of technology you have to do to enhance the show.
Yeah.
But there's also still there's four piece bands that are out there just killing. You got Justin Timberlake, like 11, 12, 13 people are in that band. And okay, you got 12 people on stage. There's not much that's going to be in the box, which is the playback world. You know, same thing like, oh, Casey's band. I walked into their rehearsal and I'm blessed enough to have been in the rehearsal. And I looked at the playback session and there's no stems. Just everything click. Was zeroed out. It was click only. And I said to John, I said, whoa, are y'all playing all this? Yeah, man. Like, we want to cover this stuff. So it's like, there's a lot of still really good bands out there that are doing cool stuff. So I don't know.
From what I hear is that, like, and to your previous insight as well, it's like the rawness and the authenticity is coming back and we're seeing it. And even though like socials are still, you know, somewhat at the top of the discoverability aspect of the music industry, you know, you're seeing even on TikTok and on Instagram, like the audience wants authentic and they want the real thing and they want the content from your bedroom and you just talking to the camera in the selfie mode or whatever. And we're seeing it now on stage as well. And to your point, to your experience with Tate, like that moment where she's sitting just at the corner, at the edge, is real. And the fans want that as well. You know, they want the pyro, but they also want the acoustic moment.
Yeah, bro. I can remember vividly in Stay Done. There is a vocal sample that plays just because we just couldn't cover it. But other than that, it's just us. So I remember vividly, like, there's this girls who are just, they have their phone up, but they're singing these lyrics like full on, like full heart, soul,
with their,
like,
chest, man.
Everything was just into them singing these lyrics. And I just felt so happy. I'm like, thank you for letting me be a part of your moment. Even though you didn't ask me to, it's like, thank you for being here, and this is like your true self. And she was like her best friend. You could tell they've been best friends, just singing their hearts out. I'm like, this is awesome. Like, thank you for letting me be a part of this moment in your life right now. And they'll never forget it. So yes, they love that authenticity for sure.
Are you seeing some new developments in the industry from your chair, from your position, that you're interested in? Maybe are there some things that you're seeing that maybe not a lot of people, maybe not a lot of fans are seeing, that may be, you know, big or something in the next few months, but that you're seeing sort of like an early glimpse of?
You mean like a job or like a skill set thing there, or
just like something that you've come across recently and you're like, oh, that's new. That'll be cool in the next few months. Maybe it's a new role in the industry, like you're saying. Maybe it's something that you've seen in the past, in the past month being on the road.
Yeah, I would definitely chime into like the playback is like, I don't know. I think it's one of the coolest jobs out there, which is also why I dove into it heavily. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot in that chair that happens that I think is really cool. And you had TJ on, so I'm sure he probably talked a bit about some of the stuff that he does with Sabrina. But like, there's so many cool things that happen in that playback world, from controlling some vocal processing to making sure you're keeping the band in order, from time code being distributed. And it can get really, really creative with controlling video and controlling program changes, meaning all the instruments that are happening in real time. Essentially, once these guys and girls program their guitar pedals and bass patches and all this other stuff, you're essentially sending out signals to control it in real time. So if you're good at your job, you never have to, your instrumentalists never have to touch their pedal board again or their keyboard again. It's like everything is going to be sent out MIDI-wise signals that are going to be able to control every aspect. Like, to me, I think that's cool as shit.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a really cool way of utilizing technology, but still keeping the players. But I'm sure there's like old school guitar players like, oh, I want to press my pedals myself. Like, okay, bro, like, we don't care. Like, if you want to do it, that's fine. Like,
no, totally. I don't know,
but it's cool stuff.
No, for sure. And just, you know, working with that allows the artists to become you know, more confident and more rely more on like a sustainable, you know, solution. And yes, technology sometimes bugs out, but to be able to not be at your pedal board and to go in, maybe not in the crowd, maybe sometimes in the crowd, but, you know, be at the forefront of the stage, and not have to, you know, press your patch change on your Nord or whatever. There's a lot of MIDI capabilities in the playback world that is so interesting, and it's only developing. We're seeing new tools every single year. To develop that, it's insane. Want to get into Jarvis here. Can you tell us about how you first got into drumming and what drew you to the instrument?
Oof. Drums is kind of the only thing that made sense. My first instrument my mom will say it was drums, but my like structured instrument was trumpet.
Okay.
And it just wasn't me.
Right.
My brain wanted it to happen, and my mind was definitely on this like, oh, this could be a really cool instrument. Mm-hmm. However, like it just didn't read quickly. And I remember, so my brothers are, one is, I think he's 15 years and 4 days ahead of me. and then the next one is 7 years ahead of me. So there's a pretty big gap.
Yeah.
So my oldest brother played drums and the drumline in high school, because that would be the right age bracket here for me to actually see him do stuff.
Right.
And I remember grabbing his mallets because he played quads, and he got upset because I was playing stuff that he couldn't play. And like, he's a teenager. I'm trying to figure things out, and right. I'm just kind of navigating this. And then my middle brother was like drum major, and just like he was in the band and played multiple instruments and blah, blah, blah. So I was always kind of naturally around music.
Right.
And I grew up in a small town, so we kind of all knew each other kind of vibe. So very fortunate that the band director, Mr. Sandlin, which is still a friend and phenomenal guy.
Shout out.
huge shout out. Just took an interest in me, and like he even gave me my first marching band harness when I was a kid. No drums, but just like you always felt cool with the harness on.
Yeah.
It's kind of like picking things up as I would go to his concerts, and all his friends are like, "Oh, your brother's good," and
yeah,
I just kind of this nurse from there. But yeah, the drums is the only thing that made sense. Is the answer to your question? Yeah.
Well, because it seemed like it was a pass down, basically.
Yeah, in a way, for sure.
Yeah. When did you realize that music was going to be your career? Was there a specific moment or performance that solidified that for you?
For sure.
Yeah.
Summer of 8th grade.
Okay.
So going into high school, I was, you could argue, semi-pro tennis player. But just highly competitive and was making money doing it. Like I've won a few competitions, that kind of stuff at the time. Okay. But tennis is a very expensive sport, and I didn't grow up rich.
Sure.
And music is also an expensive thing. And one thing about my personality is that I don't do anything half-assed. So everything I was doing was just like all in.
So
you know what I mean? I was like, all right, if Jarvis said he's doing it, it's like, buckle up, because this is what's happening.
Right.
So my dad made me make kind of like an indirect decision. It wasn't like a sit down, like hard, like you got to choose, but it was kind of just like, hey man, you got to start getting a little more serious about one of these things, either direction. Right. Like you got to go with this music thing, or you kind of need to drop the music and we got to start putting you in some other stuff for tennis, because either direction here, we just got to go that route and you can't really split your time.
Right.
He didn't say it as eloquently as I'm saying it, but you know, the conversation happened.
Sure.
So then I just chose music, and I chose it off of this reason. It was the only thing when I was frustrated, I still wanted to keep going and do.
Right.
If that makes sense. Like tennis, oh, I would definitely get pissed off. I would lose a match and, you know, I want to slam my rackets or break strings and, you know, throw my shoes across the court. Like I was just like, it was like a real big outburst.
Yep.
With music, it's like, shit, I missed that lick, but it's like, I'm not leaving here until I nail it.
Yeah.
You know, it was one of those types of things. That's frustrating for sure, but it's like, once you get it, you're like, ooh, I'm killing all. Like,
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that was the deciding factor right there. It was the only thing that didn't frustrate me.
Yeah, no, I mean, I see myself in that story. I used to play like competitive baseball, and
oh, sick.
You know, come home, you know, very frustrated in the car, you know, throwing the gloves in the bag, the cleats and shit. And with music, I didn't have that. You know, it was like, okay, let's go again, let's press play again. You know, let's get those shots in. Let's do all that stuff. And it always felt more of like a not necessarily community, but a team, you know. I'm sure you felt that in tennis, where it is a solo sport. So you don't, you're only necessarily like relying on yourself.
Yep.
But let's say in music, if you miss that lick, it's going to show bad, like it's going to, you know, be bad for everybody. So anyway, I see that and see your journey and myself and, I get that. It was sports versus music for me as well. Who were some of your early influences and how did they shape your musical journey?
Oh boy. So I grew up playing jazz, like hardcore bebop, big band, like heavy. So, you know, I was definitely into like the Count Basie. So Sonny Payne.
Yeah.
A lot of cats don't even know that name, but they know all the records that dude is played on. But I remember watching a DVD of him, just like, it just felt great.
Sure.
You know, just felt amazing. He was just cool and suave and everything was just very intentional.
Yeah.
And then you obviously have like the greats when it comes to the drummers like Buddy Rich, Gene Krupa. And then at that time growing up, I was getting towards the modern guys at the time, such as like Dave Weckl, Vinny Caliuta.
Yeah.
And then I discovered Pat Metheny. So then I fell down the rabbit hole of Antonio Sanchez. And like, that just like blew my mind over stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just started playing also like black metal. So like I was like into like Seosin and all this other stuff. It's like you're just diving into a wide variety of things and like 311. It's like, and then you find like Dave Matthews Band. It's like there's so many different things. But yeah, I would say that's the earliest stuff, is like listening to like the real jazz heads, like really, really locked in.
Right.
Like the art of drumming.
Yeah.
Really. And then it just kind of has evolved for sure. But yeah, those cats are still the ones that I'll reference if I'm just, even if you're low, you go to practice some stuff, you're like, you forgot this one Art Blakey lick, you know, like, all right, cool.
And you're talking about some of the, like your favorite drummers, you know?
Yeah.
It's like some of those cats, for sure. I just want to ask you this because I have, you know, some of the references for myself and my drumming sort of journey. Do you remember the video, like maybe it was YouTube, maybe it was a DVD that like really changed like things for you, unlocked something?
Oh man.
Like the first time that you saw one of the videos that you're like, holy shit, this is crazy.
There's a few actually.
Yeah, there's a few.
Yeah, no, I mean legit, like there's a few. And even to this day, there's definitely videos I can recall, like modern right now.
Yeah.
Definitely Channel One Suite, Buddy Rich, insane.
Yeah.
I remember watching when I first discovered, like I said, Pat Metheny, and then diving into Antonio Sanchez. You'll hear things on like what is the album called? The Way, but it's in like three parts or something like that.
Okay.
Or four parts, excuse me. It's an opener, part one, two, three, four, or part three, excuse me. There's parts in there that you think a percussionist is covering. It's not like Antonio is playing some shit over here and you're like, whoa. But you don't know what's happening until you watch the DVD. And you're like, what is this left foot clave action you got going? Time out, mom. we're on the way to the music store because I got to learn this thing.
Right.
And then like the old clip of Tony Versa Jr. playing like that Red Pearl kit, like, knock it off, bro. Like that dude was in there just destroying things as a child. And you're like, all right, I guess this is the standard.
Yeah. Yeah. Tony Reister Jr. And even like the recent clips of him playing like jazz in a lounge. I don't know if you're on that, but
100%,
that's like,
bro.
That's like, what? Like, I didn't know you were also doing this.
Like, yo, Tony's just, the man. I don't care what no one says. Tony is the man.
It's insane. It's insane. And even Tony's, yeah, like Tony's like child videos are stupid. Anyway.
Yeah, insane. And I would definitely say there's one more. So in drummer world, there's a trio of Dave Weckl, Steve Gadd, and Vinny Caliuta. Come on. Like, what are we talking about right now? They lock into that groove. Ugh.
Insane.
It's yeah.
Stuff.
So good.
I would want to, I mean, I know that there's so much between the beginning and now, but how did you first get involved with artists such as Tate? And in your typical process, is there an audition? Is it all sort of, you know, recommendations, like word of mouth stuff? Like, what's that process like for you?
Sure. So like I said, I started with jazz, so it took me a while to really understand mainstream music.
Yeah.
I didn't grow up in the church like a lot of the drummers that are on similar gigs as myself.
Yeah.
So I had a huge learning curve to get to this place. Also, those guys who grew up in church already had the chops, the licks, the phrasing, the feel, the understanding of what was going on. They, when we got to this level, are now just learning how to incorporate electronics. I'm having to do both in real time.
Right.
So that was a huge process. When it comes down to getting work, there's sometimes like open calls to do certain things.
Right.
And I'll say this about those. Some are legit and some aren't. Yeah. What I would say is just ask yourself who's putting an open call on and what their reach is. And if their reach is real, why are they having an open call? And it's not to say that anyone who has done this is like a bad person or anything like that. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is sometimes you'll have people who do an open call and yeah, they might be in charge of it, which is fantastic. But if they're not referring out their friends or calling their friends to ask a friend of a friend, you got to think maybe why is that happening?
Right.
Maybe they have pure intentions of trying to increase their network. You know, maybe they're trying to grow their company, which is very possible. Or maybe the budget isn't great. So you have to decide, okay, even if I was to get this gig, would I go out for X amount of dollars? Because just remember, if this person has a reach, they could call their friends to go do something, but if they're not calling their friends, this probably has to do with the money, nothing else.
Right.
So yeah, just be mindful about that. So yeah, open calls do exist. But a lot of the times, man, it is very much so word of mouth.
Yes.
This industry is about who you know. And I'll also kind of address one thing. I know I do consultations as well. And I get a lot of up and coming drummers and musicians that are like, I feel like there's like a lot of gatekeeping. I'm like, man, I can empathize with what you're saying until I got into the room and realized that's not what's happening.
Yeah.
What's happening is that you have people who have an ecosystem and a system of how they like to run things. And the more efficient their system is, the faster everything can happen. And there's a lot of levers or levels to that system, right? It's, are you on time? Are you reliable? Do you know my method of Dropbox? Do you know my method of returning files back to me? Do you know my method of how I like to run my rehearsals? Do you know the people in the room? Can I trust that you're not going to say anything crazy to this 16-year-old artist because she's in the room right now and I know you like to cuss? Like, you know, there's levels to that.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I have a sober artist and I know you smoke weed all the time. Like, are you coherent enough to realize maybe you need to be on a pen for this run and not smoke weed? Like, there's levels to that that musical directors are thinking about before they hire out somebody. So when you got people like, let's just use like the big fish in this situation, like Adam Blackstone and Chris Pooley and Darren and Javon and Derek Cobbs and all these people, it's like they didn't get to that place having fuck ups, you know? And if they did have mess ups, it wasn't enough to mess up their career, but they were learning from it and adapting and molding natures. And when they do that, they were building a team. I know NFP working with DJ like the back of my hand. I know the structure. I know how he likes to walk. I know how he likes to talk.
Yep.
And I'll give a clear example. DJ is one of the best drummers in the world. I don't care what anyone says. DJ is a drummer's drummer, and he's also an artist drummer. When that guy sits on those drums, he's going to make anything feel amazing. DJ likes to think behind drums a lot of times. He's not always going to play everything because he has to empty a bunch of accounts, and that's just not how it works. Mm-hmm. So he'll call you in to play the drums, but he likes to think back there. So he's going to play your part for you. There's not a lot of people that would do that. But if you're not aware about how he thinks in his system, you could think you're messing up.
Right.
In reality, he's not thinking that at all. He's just like, okay, I think this feels here. Okay, let's try to approach this way. Like, he's just in real time thinking.
Yep.
So when he calls people, he knows, okay, my playback engineer knows how I like everything labeled already. He knows my Dropbox folder. He knows how this has worked. So I don't have to teach him and work through the system. He knows my color coding and my sessions. He knows not to consolidate things. Like, I like things this way. So if I have to go back into it, I can get to it. I know what's going on. Same thing with monitors front of the house. Like, this is the NFP sound. So there's certain things that need to happen. So you carving out frequencies kind of carves away some of the sounds. Like, these guys all know this stuff.
Right.
So to me, it's not about that. And don't get me wrong, Chris Pooley has his systems. I'm certain. I've never worked with him directly, but 100%. You don't get to do an American Idol without a solid system.
Yep.
You know, Ricky Minor probably has the same system. Like, people have systems of how things work. Adam has a system, I know for sure.
Edwin Carranza.
Edwin, the homie. They all have a system, right? It's like, everybody knows what's going on. So it's not about gatekeeping. It's like, I have to trust you in my network, in my ecosystem, to make sure you're not slowing down this process.
Yeah.
Because I just don't have all day to be here. And if I got a bunch of killing guys in this room and girls in general, and we could get this done in 6 hours, I don't need to be here for 12.
Yep.
I'd rather go home. I got things to do. Or I could just do nothing. So it's like the system. So it's not really gatekeeping. So yes, to answer your question, it's all about networking and who you know, and establishing some type of trust and rapport to get into that room to make them feel comfortable calling you for whatever job that is.
Right. And to me, this, what you're saying is that getting their trust and getting a connection with them out of the room is important first.
100%.
Yeah.
It's never not that. Like, it's always being a good person first.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Always.
Fantastic. What has it been like working with some of the biggest artists at the moment, especially during, and I want to, you know, specifically with Tate now. And, you know, I also want to be careful with NDAs, things like that.
Sure.
What has it been like working with her, especially in her rise now, you know, over the past couple of years?
Yeah. Rewarding.
Yeah.
Like, very sure. Rewarding. And I always kind of like, I don't cringe at this type of a question, but it's fine when I can say it to someone. It's icky when you have to type it out.
sure. I get that.
You know what I mean? Because it's always just like, no matter what I say, I have to say the artist is amazing. But when I'm in real time, I could actually convey emotionally that, no, Tate is actually amazing.
Right.
She's really good person, number one. I've never seen her in like a bad mood. I've never seen her not ready to work. I've never seen her like disrespect anyone on the team. Mm-hmm. She always speaks to you. She will always give you a hug. Like, she always acknowledges that you exist. So, and one of the most infectious laughs ever. Like, just listening to her laugh with the dancers and her, you know,
yeah.
back and forth with us. Like, it's refreshing. So, yeah, she's amazing in that sense. But also just the whole structure and the team itself is phenomenal.
Mm.
Like, really phenomenal. And it's kind of being a part of that ecosystem has been great. And I think it kind of helps define what you're willing to do in next camps or not. Because
yeah,
they have sure. such a really, really great system of how things work. Is it perfect? No. But they're always trying to get better at that. And I think anyone on that team will say that. Like, right. You're never going to badmouth the tour manager, stage manager, production manager. Like, they're all amazing at what they do.
Yeah.
So yeah. And being with her on the rise has been rewarding because we were with her for a lot of firsts this year.
Yes.
Her first MSG, her first Lollapalooza, her first world tour going into these types of rooms, her first 20,000 people, her first 17,000 people, her first 10,000 people.
Yeah.
Her first reveal of a new song, you know, you're with her to do her first collaboration with Megan Maroney, her first collaboration with Kid Laroi. Like you're with her for a ton of first.
Yeah.
And I never take it for granted the blessing being a part of that journey because she doesn't have to pick me. You know, she doesn't have to say, oh, yeah, she doesn't have to have a band. She wants to have a band and she appreciates the band. So I just appreciate her and the entire team for allowing us to be a part of this journey and rocking with her and hopefully for many more tours to go.
Fantastic. What were some of the most, you know, in preparing for this world tour that you're on right now, what are some of the most challenging and rewarding and maybe some learning opportunities that you had during the preparing for this tour?
Yeah, a lot, actually. The drummer I was when I got the call is not the drummer I am now.
There you go.
Hands down. I stepped into DJ's shoes, which is hard. It's really, really hard to do. So I had to have a lot of talks with God just to kind of drop the imposter syndrome feeling.
Yeah.
And say, okay, cool. He called you for a reason. You need to buckle in and let's get ready to go.
Sure.
So the time that I got the call, we were coming into rehearsals for the Europe and UK part of this run. And at that time, there was a lot of things happening for NFP, which there always is a lot of things happening for NFP, thank God.
Yes.
But it was like a really big height of things where Coachella performances were happening with three different artists.
Doja, sorry, yeah, that performance, I know there's so much going on, but DJ specifically in that performance, Derek Cobbs as well, it's stupid.
It's insane. But there was all of our resources were pretty much being tapped out.
Yeah.
And when you're programming these types of shows and all your programmers are also working, everything is not always fast because everyone needs your attention. Yeah. So one of the hardest things is Zach played a lot of the music, which is good, the guitarist. I had played none of the music and there was still a lot of arrangements that weren't done going into rehearsals. So one, I had to learn DJ's approach because that's what Tate is most comfortable with right now. And little professional nugget for people is that you want to make your artist as comfortable as possible. It's just that simple. So if she was already accustomed to something, she's already approved something, she's already used to dancing to something, she's already used to phrasing. It's like you need to try to match that before you try to change it. Mm. At least that was my approach.
Yep.
So I had to go back and listen to a lot of videos that he did. And I transcribed a lot of his fills and setups just to make sure, at least right now, when he comes in, he's like, cool, that works. You could also stretch out here if you want to, or let's not do that. Or
it
was already approved because it's already out. Do that first and then dive in.
And I have to add, especially here, because with a show like Tate, which is very movement heavy.
Yeah.
A lot of shots and a lot of these fills and a lot of these moments and these stops and stuff are very, very important. So, you know, I hear what you're saying and it's so true.
Yeah. And very important for a wide variety of reasons. We have six dancers on stage, excluding Tate. Tate's also an amazing dancer.
Yes.
So your setups need to be the same because they've probably choreographed some of the stuff based off your live recordings that you sent them in rehearsal.
Exactly.
And these hits and stops and stuff all need to make sense because there's lighting involved now. There's dancers that have to stop movement. There's hand gestures, there's flickering of stuff. Like there's video screens going out. It's not just about you chopping through or doing whatever feel you want to. It's like, no. It all needs to make sense for the greater good of the production. So
Yes.
You could probably listen to a bunch of different shows. And the only, there's definitely some fills that are very different, but a lot of them are the same. There are a lot of the same setups. There are a lot of the same hits on certain stacks at a certain time. There's a lot
accents,
of
sense.
Like,
yeah.
It's exactly the same because she gets used to that. She can embellish certain things. Like she can choose to melodically go to something different. If Zach is playing a lead line, if she wants to, like you want her to be comfortable. You want everyone to have familiarity and know this is what we're doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that was number one, the hardest part, because we didn't get a lot of the material, and Tate is also a workhorse to her credit. So she wanted to come in, I think, the second day. DJ wasn't always in the room. So we had Nick Diorio, great guy, in the room helping us, which was a huge, huge help. But I think it was like 14 songs I didn't get to play. And when she went to come in, DJ was literally on some praise and worship kind of stuff, talking in a talkback, walking me through the song in real time. You know, swell, like play this here.
Sure. That's hilarious.
Which is normal. You know, it's like you kind of have to get through it in that moment.
Yeah.
So that was hard. And then also I double on keys on this gig.
Yes.
So every single day, I would say about 80% of the time, you're going to get a brand new song for a VIP.
Yeah.
So I have to learn a new song every single day. And that's after our original sound check that we decide whatever that song is. It's not sent to us by management. It's in real time. She's like, I'm going to try this. Cool. For the most part, everything is pretty straightforward. Nothing too crazy, but you still got to program a keyboard. And this is your second instrument.
Yes.
So it's like, you know, there's definitely some challenges with that sometimes. But definitely on the break from the Europe leg to US, I spent hours practicing and learning the ins and outs of the Phantom. Like I was like, this is not going to hold me up at all.
Yeah.
And I would say it definitely translated to moments like when Megan came out and performed with us. We were originally told that she just wanted to play acoustic guitar and have Tate sing, which is totally fine. It would have been a magical moment.
Yeah.
But Zach and I just kind of took it upon ourselves and make sure we learned the record just in case. Because if she did ask for it, then we're here.
Yeah.
If she doesn't ask for it, we're still here. And you never know what's going to happen. Like her guitar can come out, it's like or can get unplugged. We don't want to make sure that we can cover it if we need to. Like you just want to make sure you're prepared.
Yeah.
So that's so translated. Like we just came in a little bit earlier. We learned the song. We listened to her live renditions, like 5 different videos, just to make sure she's singing in that key.
Right.
And then we also learned it in a better key for Tate, just to make sure whatever the conversation was. But that's challenging sometimes. And I would say the other major challenge was MSG was a pretty challenging day for us.
Yep.
So we had a day before just so everybody can load in, and we were supposed to get a rehearsal in for this new song that was released. That didn't happen.
Ain't no way.
So we learned that song in real time with her on the stage and singing it in real time. Thank God for DJ again. but, you know, it's like one of those moments that could be, it's like you got 20,000 people that are getting ready to show up here and you don't want to mess up this release because that's going to be one of the most clipped moments of that show.
Yep.
So, you know, it is what it is. But I would say those are the three moments of first getting a gig, not having the material and having to sit in on that moment, learning keys proficiently enough and et cetera. And then MSG, just the challenges of the day and the stakes of the day.
Yeah. And you mentioned the keys stuff. Can you talk about how these diverse skills, you mentioned playback, keys, MDing, drumming, how these diverse skills have contributed to your success in getting gigs, getting different calls, even just getting one opportunity that could ask for multiple roles?
Sure. I would also add teching to that, man.
Yes,
that was a
big
part of how I got my foot in the door and got to meet people and they got to get along with my personality.
Mm-hmm.
That was huge, like teching for Money Long and doing kit builds for RJ Kelly for American Idol. Like those moments of, and a lot of that stuff wasn't paid. I just wanted to figure out a way to get in the room.
Yes.
And let people know, like, I exist and hope you like me. You know, like, truly, I hope you like me.
Yeah.
But it definitely comes into play, man. Like, I originally got my first, I would say my first professional gig with DJ was me on playback. It wasn't on drums.
Right.
Actually, you know what? I'm lying to you. My first major gig with DJ was on drums. It was for Jordan, but he wasn't there.
Sure.
I actually just finished a tour, got a text from him asking if I was available for some dates. Didn't even know who it was for. I was like, yeah, I'm actually on the way back home right now. I think it was like 2 days later, the gig was, and I just got an email like what the artist, what was going on. And then this is what's happening.
Sure.
But real example of like being prepared is originally that show was always supposed to be an acoustic show with me on like trap percussion and like little chill stuff and a guitarist on acoustic guitar.
Right.
But okay, cool. You know what I mean? At a stadium, I was like, that seems a little wild to me, but cool. If that's what they're asking for, let's get it.
Sure.
And then the day before, we get an email saying, hey, we realized what this event was. It's actually a little bit bigger. Do you guys mind sending a writer to actually do a full-on performance? And Jarvis, do you mind running backing tracks? Okay. You know what I mean? But knowing playback, I had already built a session for me to learn. So that's actually how I learn things is I take MP3s and I throw them into Ableton and I build a session out just because my brain, like, it's just how I think. But I had already done it. So I was like, yeah, let's get it. All I had to do was put in, you know, some actual like real markers and make sure I can navigate it if something goes south.
Right.
But having the skill set to even build a session and balance tracks out and understand how the outputs are and be able to send over, you know, an Excel sheet or a document over to have all the inputs and all that good stuff sorted and speaking the lingo. It's like not having that playback capability. I probably couldn't have done that gig and then it would have been a disaster in real time.
Yep.
Doing that gig. So
yeah.
Definitely having multiple skill sets matter. And I would definitely say most people I know who are working professionals do more than one thing.
Oh yeah.
And well.
Yes.
Like really well.
Yeah. What advice would you give to other musicians who want to diversify their skills and work in various roles in the music industry? You know, you mentioned teching, all the musician roles that you're occupying, playback, music, MDing, et cetera.
Sure. I'll start by saying this. There's three reasons why you're not working. It's your skill set. Slash talent. You know, do you have the skills? Are you equipped with all the right things to be on your instrument or playback or whatever you're doing professionally? Do you have the skills to do the job? The second one is your network. Do people know you have those skills? Have they seen you do those skills? Do they trust that you actually have those skills? And then do you know the people that are going to employ the people who need that skill set? And the third one is being a good person. I don't know anyone who has all three of those things that's not working. I just don't think it's a real thing. If you're missing one of those things, I can understand why you're not working. If you're an asshole, but really talented and you know all the right people, well, it doesn't matter because no one wants to be around you. You're not going to work. You can be a really cool person with a great skill set, but if no one knows you, they ain't calling you because I don't know you exist on the earth.
Yes.
You know, and you could be a really cool person with a great network, but you're not skilled enough to get calls. Full transparency, I wasn't always getting calls to do things. And my friends are my friends. Like, straight up, I just named two of my really good friends, DJ and John Witt. They are a call for a lot of major things. And that's to play and also put things together.
Yep.
You got to ask yourself, if your best friends are doing certain things and they're not calling you, why not? You got to really be honest with yourself and then also be smart enough to know that you can't ask this question of like, put me on. I asked the question of, yo, who are your favorite drummers and what do they bring to the table that makes you feel good about calling them? And once I figured that out, I quickly realized I didn't have the things you needed to trust me. It wasn't that you didn't trust me as a friend. It wasn't that you didn't know I existed. It doesn't mean that you didn't know I wasn't going to say something crazy in front of this female artist or some management. It wasn't any of that. It's like, I couldn't do the job straight right. up. So like I said, it's just those three things. So it doesn't matter if you have a good network and a good person with those skills. You need all three to work. And
can I ask you what you did in that situation?
Yeah, dude, I went into the shed, bro. Like,
yes, sir.
I went and locked in for a long time, but I also didn't have a backup plan. So that's also when I got into teching. I got a situation where it was just like, let me call my drum homies. Because once again, I have friends and I could set up drums. I tune drums like no one's business. I could do that. So let me get into the door. And in the meantime, I'm meeting MDs, blah, blah, blah. But yeah. I'm also getting real time to see how Deshaun Allen approaches Money Long. I get a real sense of, I could see RJ playing this show and be like, oh crap, I don't think I could do that. Cool, but I'm clocking how you're approaching it. I'm clocking how people are talking to you. And I'm like, got it. I see why you wouldn't call me. Because if you would have made a change to me in that moment, I would have missed that every time because I wasn't thinking that. So yeah, that's what I did, bro. I dove into those drummers that I was told, listened to what they did. I booked a consultation with Tony Mercer Jr.
Yes, sir.
I booked a consultation with Brian Fraser Moore. I took lessons with Ray Marshall Jr. I asked questions and sent clips to my friends like, yo, when you get time, do you mind taking a look and taking a listen about what do you think? And getting response back like, oh, you thought that was good, didn't you? Cool. Go redo that. Getting advice like everything you need is in the song. Listen to the song. You know, still not employing me, but they're definitely being able to see progress in real time or not.
Yes.
And letting
them know that you're interested and dedicated to making the next steps as well.
Bro, absolutely. And that's major, man. Like DJ and I went to dinner with Zach right after Lollapalooza.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things he said. He's like, bro, I've had multiple conversations about you just on how dedicated you are about being good and being the best at what you're doing. And you listen. He's like, that to us is everything more of just like someone with crazy work ethic. He's like, you being a good hang was always easy. That was never the problem. Right. It's like, now that we see you're equipped and you're hungry and you're wanting to work with us, bro, it's like, we're having conversations about you. Like, I'm blessed enough to be in conversations where they were trying to figure out where they wanted to send me. Not if they were going to send me, where they needed me.
Yes.
So hearing that, and I didn't know any of that. I'm in the grind mode and I'm still in grind mode. Like I can't wait to go back and shed. Like we're locked.
Yes.
But those things matter, man. And when your friends, like John sent me a message one time, and I hope it's okay that I share this, but he was like, I've hesitated sending this message for you because I don't want you to let up, but how you're approaching things and you're playing has been really, really good. And then he referred me out to do some stuff too. And I was like, wow, this is a blessing. Now you're getting your best friend, who also you look so greatly up to.
Yes.
Feels comfortable throwing your name in a hat for things. And obviously no guarantee, but it's just like, I feel comfortable throwing your name in the hat that if you do get the job, you're not going to let me down and embarrass me. Awesome. You know, that means the world to me in those moments. So that's what I did. I got in the shed, man, and let them know that I was listening.
Yeah. And it's really important. Because they also see that they're important to you. You know, it's a relationship and it's a two-way relationship. And it's really great.
Yeah.
I want to ask you a specific question that may be a little inside for drummers here, but how do you see the role of live drumming evolving? You know, I wanted to ask you this because, like, knowing that you're not necessarily coming from the gospel scene, inside, you know, I'm seeing myself the gospel vocabulary in drumming is so present in live pop music right now. How are you seeing the live drummer role evolving at the moment?
Oh man, I think I'm going to answer this as a person who has a seat and then that person that's like witnessing kind of the ecosystem of drumming.
Yep.
I think there's a lot of incredible drummers. And I mean, absolutely incredible. And their kids, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16, that are blazing. I'm like, I couldn't do any of those chops. So I think that's a beautiful thing, because they're going to keep pushing the envelope. You know, they're going to really go for it in terms of pushing the skills that are on drums and all this other stuff. In terms of just what I think people should do to prepare to be a professional drummer, I think hybrid drumming is an absolute must.
Yes.
You're seeing it in genres that you usually didn't see it in. You're seeing it in rock. You're seeing it in punk music. You're hearing it in country music. You know, there's a lot of people who are really incorporating electronics because they want, we're at the technology point where we can make the record still sound like the record now live. Mm-hmm. You didn't always have that option, or years ago, it could translate live because it was live musicians that played it. You know, yeah. It was that aspect, and it brought a whole band out. But we were in this era now where a lot of it is a producer or multiple producers who are sending files back and forth with different samples and different cuts and blah, blah, blah. That's not live. Mm-hmm. So in order for you to keep your job, you have to figure out a way to make sure you can make this record sound like the actual record while still being a drummer.
Yes.
That's the job. And there's a lot of things, like most verses in Tate's music, I'm playing electronics only.
Yeah.
There's not any live anything. There might be a hi-hat join or a little splash action that kind of accents something, but everything else is all triggers. My kick always has a trigger on it. I would say most of my snares have triggers on them. There's e-kicks, there's samples that I have to hit. Like, there's things that you have to do, mm-hmm. because, like, if I didn't do that, well, live drums don't need to be in this part. So what do? Sit here? Like, you can't just do this and it's like, oh, yeah, I'll play now. Like, no. You got to do something, bro. So, yeah, I would say that's where it is. Like, if you're not hip to your electronics, get hip to your electronics. And it doesn't matter what you use. Well, I'll use that loosely. It does matter what you use, but to get started, the fundamentals of it is always going to be the same. If you have an old SPDES, cool, use that if that's what's accessible for you. If you have the Essex, use that. The Pro, use that. The TD50, like whatever you have, the Yamaha DTX. Like, if you have something to get incorporated and start messing with the concepts and figuring out, oh crap, I can't play this fill like this anymore because there's a kick sample here that doesn't sound good if I start chopping quickly. I have a snare sample on my snare. Like, I can't actually move because it's a clap. You can't go, bug it up. Like, what are you doing? You can't do that because you have a snare. But if you can get that concept before you go into a real room and get a real call, you're already going to know how to fill while still playing the part.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's where drumming is heading. It's like, get on your hybrid.
Fantastic. The 2 and the 4, man. You know what I'm saying?
That's it. Stay there. If you can make that thing feel good, you'll be working, brother.
There you go. In what ways has your work with major musicians and just your work just generally impacted your personal growth, both as a musician and a person?
Oh, man. Majorly. Because I don't know. I know them, but there's not a lot of them that I associate with all the time that aren't really, really good people and good with business, good with people, good with their children, good with their wives, good with their husbands. Like, I just don't know that to be true. So once again, it's like, if you millionaires don't hang out with thousandaires. They may have one or two friends from childhood, but they usually associate with people who are like-minded, who are going to push the envelope. Right. Billionaires aren't going to befriend, you know, a person in poverty. Doesn't mean they don't know them. Doesn't mean they're going to disrespect them. It's like, but we don't think the same. We don't move the same. And our goals clearly aren't the same right now with where you're at. Yeah. So if you're aware of those things socially, it's like, well, do you want to keep being in the conversation? The answer is yes. So you need to kind of move how they're moving, as long as it doesn't compromise what you do morally, right? There's definitely people who do things that are immoral, and cool, you can stay away from that because that's up to you and God to have that conversation. But you do have your friends who are buying homes, and if you have friends who have homes, they also want friends to have homes, right? It's naturally what yes. they want. They don't want you to be poor and have, you know, 1500 roommates. Not that they're not empathetic to you living in Los Angeles and having to rent, but they're definitely still going to challenge you to be like, yo, are you considering buying now? Like, where are you at?
Right.
If your friends are married, they're not going to want to see their homeboy out here just conquering and pillaging as they go along. They want you to settle down. They want you to be a part of their ecosystem of like, yo, we're keeping things chill and wholesome around here. We just happen to be really good at our instruments.
Right. Yeah.
Overall, we want to do family vacations and we like our kids and we like our wives and we like our husbands. And it's like, this is where we're at. So yes. If you're just want to do drugs and all this other stuff, that's cool, bro. Go do that. But you can't come around here doing that. So when you realize that the A-list musicians, for the most part, are moving that way, you don't have a choice. You know, by default, you either have to rise to it or they're not going to bring you along for the journey because you don't think the same. You're not moving the same. Like, you're buying nice clothes instead of buying a home. Not saying there's anything wrong with buying clothes, but if you're spending all your money on your car and then you go drive that nice car and you got 16 roommates, your priorities are messed up. Like, that's why we're not thinking the same. It's not really about what you have. It's about what you're doing with what you have and how you're navigating this. It allows us to be like, I could build you up and I could bring you around or not.
Mm.
So yeah, it's changed my whole life, man. Like, first time for this year, I've actually journaled out what I wanted to do. Really focused on what I wanted to do. I've changed like my wallpaper, my background to be intentional. I've unfollowed a bunch of accounts. I've unfollowed a bunch of people and nothing personal to them. It's just like what you consume all the time starts to become your reality. Mm-hmm. So to me, I'm like, we started out, NFP had this thing, DJ, once again, fearless leader, sent out a mass text to everyone top of the year just saying, this is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to eat clean. This is the kind of the parameters of what we did for this challenge, which is a beautiful thing. And he extended it out to a bunch of different people in different camps and whatever. But he quickly like started removing people from the group. And it wasn't that he doesn't like them. It doesn't that he didn't care for them. It doesn't matter, want him to like, doesn't mean he doesn't want them to do whatever, but he wanted people around him that are going to make sure he's held accountable for eating yes. well and going to the gym. And did you read the Bible today? It's like, did you pray today? It's like, he wants those people around him right now. Once again, not saying that those people who didn't do the thing don't mean anything to him because he does not feel that way at all.
Right.
But when you're trying to move as a unit, you know, you're not going to be an alcoholic and hang out a bunch of alcoholics. You're going to hang out a bunch of people who are sober. You know, if you're God-fearing, you're not going to hang out with a bunch of degenerates because you're worried about answering to God. You know, if you want to be an A-list musician, well, I'm not going to do things that would make you not want to call me and not practice to do all these things. I'm going to make sure I'm moving the way these A-list musicians are. So, like I said, most of them are really good men, really good women, move with love and genuineness. Do we have flaws? Duh. But they're moving with a certain poise that you find yourself wanting to yearn and be connected with. And you want to be in the conversation where people are like Jarvis and people are like, oh, I love that dude. Great. You know, like that, that's all I want.
Yes.
If you love what I play, that's cool too. But as long as you're like, yo, Jarvis is a cool dude, like always help me out or would always speak to me. You could ask anyone on the crew. I never walk past anyone.
Yeah.
I always address them. I will go into the room. I'll talk to them. Not because I feel like I'm obligated to. I think this is the right thing to do. And they're really cool fucking people.
Right.
You just got to talk to them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would say overall, it's changed everything. Yeah. 100%.
What's one piece of advice you'd give to your younger self just starting out in the music industry?
Listen more. Forget everything you know. Because most people don't have it figured out. And the more I do it and the more I see how the magic is done, bro, we're all figuring it out. Like, no one is like, I have it figured out. They have systems that they know for sure.
Right.
But, bro, when we get these notes back from creative and it's like, you want what? Okay. You know, and then you figure it out. Are you like, okay, crap, I can't figure it out. Let me call my homie. Hey, you hear something? Because I don't know.
Right.
Like, so yeah, forget everything you know. And listen more, because the more you listen and not have a emotional response to things, I think you're a lot more sound with the information that you're receiving. When you're so eager to respond, that puts you in a spot where you're definitely going to miss information. And translating that to music, it's like, if you listen to a song and you immediately start playing, you've missed the whole song. You don't know that record. You might have maybe the general gist or whatever,
right?
But you missed the pattern. You didn't hear those backgrounds. You didn't know that lead line came in. You don't know the song, whatever. But if you take one or two passes to actually listen to the song, okay, cool. They're singing about this. So I need to have a feeling of grunginess with this if I need to. I need to have a feeling of, oh, this needs to be uplifting and your fills are going to translate that way. Cool. So now you understand the essence. Now you start diving into actually learning the song. It's like, oh, those hi-hats aren't just up. There is an accent on that. Or the accent is every third. Listen more and not be so eager to respond, aka play right away. Listen, then understand what's happening, and then attempt to play.
Fantastic. Just wanted to ask you one last question before we dive into the game. What's the dream?
To always be in valuable assets, my friends, and to make God proud. God proud is number one. I have a huge fear of when I die, God saying, this is what you could have been. Major fear of that. Mm. But while here on earth, always being an asset to my friends. I never want them to not be able to challenge my views, my ideas, my thoughts, my physicality. I don't want them to ever feel like they can't call me for an answer for something. I don't want them to feel like they can't call me to just scream if they need to. I don't want them to feel like they can't call me to say, I hate my wife, but I love my wife right now, but she's getting on my fucking nerves, and trust that I'm going to give him sound advice to be like, hey, you love her, right? Cool. So why don't you come over? You can yell at me. Let's get you okay. And you can't bring any of that tension back to your wife. Mm-hmm. Cool. I want you to have that comfortability to pick up the phone and trust that, because, bro, there's a shelf life on what we do with music. I don't care what anyone says. There's a shelf life on it. But our relationships, I think, are the things that last forever. And the impact that we have on individuals will last forever. So that's the dream. The dream is to be a valuable player in my friends' lives.
Beautifully said, man. Fantastic.
Thank you.
That's how we sort of wrap it up. But before we go, I want to do a little game with you. For those listening, maybe it's your first time. Hopefully it's not the last time you listen to this podcast. This week we're playing the Dream Fest game, which is basically giving our guest this week, it's Jarvis, the chance to basically design their own festival. From the basically like the creative director's chair. I basically asked my guest who would be playing at this festival, where it would be, when, like as in time of year, the era. So is it could be, you know, it could be in the 60s, it could be now, it could be in the future, whatever they want. How they would put their signature on this festival as the creative director. And if there was one food or beverage that they'd serve that would best represent my guest, what would it be? So this week we have Jarvis Barnes on the pod. Jarvis, where would you want to start with this Dream Festival?
Oh, my word. This is so loaded. And I hope that this is on some like dream of Harry Potter magic wand energy. Because as soon as I list this list, we're going to be like, you can't afford this. No shit.
No. Without any budgets in mind, it can also be dead or alive. I don't know if that makes it easy.
Stop. Oh, game time. Let's go. okay. Ultimate Festival would definitely have to be somewhere in the States.
Yeah.
I would say a place like Chicago or like Nashville, somewhere homey. That has good energy around it. LA is cool, but it definitely has like some energies here that aren't always ideal.
Sure.
And then lineup, all my days. Michael Jackson.
Let's get three.
Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
Rihanna's coming back.
Shout out Adam Blackstone.
Yeah, like Rihanna's definitely got to be up. And then, oh my gosh, if you want to paralyze the whole world, throw like Beyonce and Jay-Z collab in there.
add more. I feel like you got a lot more.
Oh, bro, of course. Put what? Like old school section? Put like Earth, Wind & Fire, Kool & the Gang.
Yes.
Make a whole section of like real music of this, like, I don't mean like musicians' music of this, like, Dave Matthews Band and John Mayer's locked in over there. Like, are you kidding me? Oh, that'd be so crazy. And then throw like the pop star like section into that, like Taylor and Sabrina and, you know, Tate. Yes. Oh my God. Ariana Grande. Throw one. Oh my days. And then you get into this, like, oh my, this could be out of control. You guys don't have a budget for this.
Zero budget. And you mentioned the city, but if there would be like one sort of venue, let's say you could bring that venue to that city, what would it be?
Oh, it's gotta be, man, I don't know what venue could hold this. If you want to like the nostalgic part of it, I guess you could do something like the Forum or like the Staples Center, that kind of like energy. You just wouldn't be able to facilitate the festival that I just lined up.
Right.
Yeah.
Those tickets would be crazy expensive.
Bro, or not.
Like, or not.
The dream is host it in like this crazy farmland of just like openness and just like, oh boy. MJ, you would definitely need something that could hold a million.
That's crazy.
Oh, that in itself would shut down the festival.
If there was one food or beverage that you'd serve that would best represent you, as a fun question, what would it be?
Soul food, baby.
There you go.
Easy work, bro.
Easy work. Well, we're those tickets are going on sale next week.
If that happens, I need full creative control.
Yeah. How would you put your signature on the festival? What would be unique about it in the Jeb way?
I would force people's hands to let me just like control their set list. Have the most brilliant minds. An ultimate dream of mine is to put like the most brilliant minds in the room and to say design a show.
Right.
Like legitimately, no budget. You take people like Derek Cobbs, DJ, John Witt, Chris Pooley, Adam Blackstone, like T-Von, like take Paul Merkinovich, take all these iconic names and they can each get their own programmer. Here's an extended amount of budget. Make magic.
Yeah.
Like, go crazy. You guys have 2 weeks. Like, I cleared you guys' schedules. Everyone's free. You're locked into this studio or multiple. Like, let's go. Like, that would be so insane. Because it would be all the right choices. Hard from Bieber. Just put all the right people in the room with all the keyboards and stuff that they need. Go. See you guys in 2 weeks.
Yeah. See you. Man, I mean, yeah. If that could happen, you know, I don't know if I'd be doing this anymore. I would just be saving up for this ticket.
Whatever show that is going to be the most magical thing that has ever happened.
Yeah.
Somebody just give me a budget, like $1 million to arrange your show.
Fantastic. Well, that's really how we end this week's episode. Thanks, Jarvis, for coming on.
Of course. I appreciate you having me, man.
Appreciate it.
Today, we had the absolute pleasure of hearing from Jarvis Jeb Barnes, an exceptional drummer, playback engineer, keyboard player, tech consultant in the music industry. I mean, there's so many roles and titles that this man has, and it's so great to hear from him. Our chat is just a testament to what it takes to make it in today's music industry, throughout his many roles, throughout his many relationships that he has. You know, I just hearing him talk about all these different connections and different camps and how all these different camps work was exceptional. And it just, you know, it just really shows to what extent being a good person and a good man is, and having your priorities at the right place. I think that's what I personally take from this episode. It's where are you at, where are your peers at, and how can you grow together? And it was such an exceptional episode. To our listeners, you can follow Jarvis on social media to keep up with his latest project and his latest tours. His Instagram and his social handle is Jarvis Jeb. That's JARVISJEB. Thank you for tuning in, everybody. Please like, comment, share, subscribe, do whatever you need to do to keep in touch with us as we bring you content in the behind the scenes of the music industry every week. Also, don't forget to join our vibrant community on the Eights Network Discord, where you can connect with like-minded individuals to learn more a little bit about what's going on in the industry, in the community, and where you can link up with a bunch of your peers. Thanks, everybody. Stay safe and see you next week. Bye.